long one with Brett.
March 18th. John and,
it gets a little interesting.
Yeah.
Because John and Brett have some good ideas to think about altering the formulation of feed that they're using. So they're planning on using a bio-organ diet that is geared towards releasing, encouraging smolt development in fish that contains some salts and lower lipids, higher protein.
Got some oddball designer feed.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it is. It came up just a couple years ago.
Yeah.
Hey, Brett, what's the name of that?
They reformulated the diet. It's now it's called Bio Supreme. It used to be their transfer diet.
Yeah.
And we're actually feeding half our ponds that diet for the last 3 weeks this year, just to kind of do a visual and see what, you know, if there's any difference in the rate that they want to migrate.
So the
out of the raceways anyway.
Cool.
So that would be the fish leaving the raceways.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as we talked about last time, I'd like to try to treat that as sort of pilot work, and then with passive tagging studies on next year's, when if and when the Lebanon dam pit tag detector gets in place,
mm-hmm.
right? Then with detections of pit tags at Lebanon and at Willamette Falls, we should kind of get a really good idea on whether either that formulation or some other feeding regime shift will help with residualism or
cool.
migration.
Nice.
But remember, you're looking at migration, which is the inverse of partial inverse of residualism. The only thing that I really got kind of that's kind of out there is based on the first year's work that Jeff McMichael did, and that's where they showed that a large number of radio tags from fish that were released low in the river ended up dead in the water high in the river up by the hatchery.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be either fish hanging a left when they were released, or it could be predation. Large numbers of carnivores and bird dancers that key in on those releases. And so one of the folks in the Mackenzie 2 years ago was able to recover a good jag of pit tags using magnets near cormorant and merganser roosting
mm-hmm.
sites in the
yeah.
water.
Yeah, right.
I wanted to say that just to find out, okay, are there a lot of pit tags there? Because that could explain a lot of the difference that Ryan noted.
Mm-hmm.
They're just not migrating, they're getting eaten.
Right.
You guys are kind of fading away. Might speak up a little bit.
Sorry.
We'll try to do that. Have you guys given any thought to reducing feed towards the last week or two and trying to make fish hungry in a way? I know we do that with some of our spring chinook. And reducing feed towards the end of that rearing period.
Yeah, that was another one of your things, right, Brett?
I couldn't quite hear Andy. What'd he say?
I'm talking about reducing feed in the last couple weeks of rearing just to make fish a little hungry, so to speak.
Yeah, we're doing that now as well. Our fish are actually larger than what they need to be. And so what we're going to do is feed through Friday and then hold the last probably 5 to 7 days. And they're on a reduced diet as they're only getting fed 4 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that I'm noticing with that is that the fin quality has really gone down. They're really nipping bad.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, I mean, we're leaning them out. I think we're going to have a really lean, you know, probably like a 4.3, 4.4 to the pound smolt. And probably by the end of the release, the fish that are remaining or going out at the end will probably be down to 4.5-ish or close. But they just, like I said, you can just look out in the pond and see those tops of the white. It's just the nature of the beast. They just, when they get hungry, they get aggressive and they start nipping.
Yeah, and I guess that's the trade-off of trying to do that procedure.
Yeah, and I mean, I've just my observations here in the past, we've had ponds with light densities too that in the same situation, they still nip. So. Mm. It's just kind of, like I said, I think it's just one of those things that's unavoidable. And if you're trying to hold feed.
Gotcha.
But.
All right.
We'll see how it goes.
Well, that sounds great. Sounds like a couple new things to try. Have we ever used this type of feed before, this Bio Supreme, anywhere else?
Not that I know.
We tried it a couple years ago here, and just kind of going off a basic just observation of them leaving the raceways, and we didn't see a difference. But according to the feed rep, he said they reformulated this diet. So that's why we thought we'd try it again. They recommend you feed it 6 weeks prior to release. We didn't kind of get our feed order in time, so we're doing 3 weeks as a start. But we'll see. He said a couple hatcheries in Washington are using it and are pleased with the results. So
great. Well, that's awesome. It sounds like we got a couple good ideas there to move off of that action item. Cam, did you have any further thoughts on... We talked about maybe developing a study.
Yeah, but not till next year. On fish that are going out in the next month. It's for either fish that are next year's brood or the brood that they're rearing now. I came away from the last hatchery management team meeting. Lance, you were there. And I guess I confused myself. Are we talking about the 2016 brood starting that study, or are we talking about using the 2015 brood and then sometime later this year get tags in them and then see how they migrate last year? And I walked away from the meeting thinking we were going to start with 2016 brood, which would put results out 2 years for the 2017 release.
If it's going to be O&M funded, that's what we should do. Because it's currently not on the budget for us.
Exactly.
And I can try to get it on the budget for next year. But, yeah, it wouldn't work out this year. So
When will the pit tag detector be put in? You
know? At Lebanon?
Yeah.
There's an update farther down in our agenda.
Fenton just set that out.
Yeah, he did.
You got an email last week?
I don't want to jump ahead too much, but it sounds like... It sounded like, according to Fenton, that ODFW is going to install antennas on two ladders and the bypass pipes during March and April for Lebanon. That's what I have. But back to that action item. Unless there's anything else.
What's the cost on, other than the recovery process, but that would be years out, what would the cost be to pit tag this... The 2016 release.
Each tag costs $1.25.
For how many fish?
So, I can't tell you. Tom can, though. Tom?
Yes?
How much does Biomart charge for, say, per 10,000 fish tagging them?
Our prices, for pit tags, our price is roughly $230 per tag.
That includes the tag and the...
That's the tag and the tagging.
Okay.
That's what they bring
a
tree.
The tag.
Oh, say again?
That's just the tag.
Oh, because the core gets tags for $1.25. I wonder what it costs to get Biomark to, like, for your paired release work.
So that's how we're making that more cost effective, is the core is providing the tags and Biomark's doing the work. And I could give you an estimate of that, but it would take me a few minutes here.
My question is if you wanted to get this information soon, that maybe we could look at an alternative source of funding other than core to run this study.
The soonest it should happen is next year. Absolutely, the soonest would be the 2015 brood. You can't tag the fish we have on hand right now; they just die.
Oh yeah, no, I understand that. I'm talking about for the 16 release.
Okay,
he's talking about the.
15 brood, 16
Once
release.
We have eggs for right now. I don't think the fish yet.
Yeah.
Hey, this Lance. So related to that, so planning for 2016 RME, that's coming up this year, right? So there would be an opportunity to put together a proposal for implementation this next cycle, right?
I believe so.
That would be for the release in April of 2016. We can solicit funds for a study. I thought
we should get it in there, and if it doesn't make the cut this year, at least we'd have it for the next cycle.
Okay.
And it seemed like the last RME, last meeting, folks were interested in at least looking at the proposal, getting it in for hatchery RME.
All right.
To answer the earlier question, it's about $8,200 per 10,000 fish labor.
Plus 12,000 for tags.
Does that include the cost of tags?
No, that's with the Corps providing the tags.
So if I can put a piece versus 12,000, it would be $20,000 per 10,000 fish. And how many fish would you need to tag?
Tom got good results from a 6,000 fish tag release group, but prefers well over that. So 10,000 would be good. 15,000 would be great. That would be for a treatment and a control.
So
20 to 30,000 tags.
If we could get $20,000 to $25,000, we could do it.
Yeah.
And get. I mean, my concern is that the steelhead have started to come into the spotlight as far as residualizing plans. I mean, that would be the next target for whoever's after us. And it would be better to have the information sooner rather than later, because there will probably be decisions made based on the radio tag study that I have some questions about that may have different results than we could get with the pit tag.
I think the pit tag is far better technology for the questions we're asking than the radio tags, because we can get a lot of fish tagged. But okay, so we're backing off of brood year 2016, and we'd need to get a study design that relates to the rearing of the fish that we'll be hatching in the next 2 months. So that's brood year 2015, mm-hmm. which really puts the pressure on to get a real study design. I was thinking ahead a year.
If you had a design and you had a cost, I think that I could wrestle this to the R&E board.
Yeah,
they would love something like this. That's the excise
target. Yeah. So is that doable, Cam, on short order?
Oh, absolutely.
Like we'll do it tonight.
Make sure that's in the notes. Absolutely.
Everything goes in the notes.
That'd probably be the best.
Well, in any case, it could be for the next cycle. If need be, if the funding doesn't come through.
Yeah, I mean, once you got the proposal together, you can chop it around wherever.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, that is doable. I've got to get all the reports, yours out anyway, certainly by August. And, okay.
All right. Okay, anything else on that one? Maybe we can take that action item off. Okay, 2.4, Lieberg trapping. Cam.
Haven't done that yet.
No? It sounded like Kurt talked to Lisa McLaughlin.
So did I.
Yeah, and they want to run that middle spill gate because it's under warranty.
That makes sense.
It does. The bloody thing is expensive. Okay, talked at length to Lisa. Okay, the thing is on a 1 year warranty. If it breaks in that year, they get it fixed. Somebody else pays for it.
Right.
If they don't use it, it can't break.
I understand.
And they've had problems with it before. So what she said she would really try and do is to lock the left spill gate, trap ladder, hatchery side spill gate, open, so there's some spill on that side, but most of the spill is going to come out of the motorized gate in the middle.
Right.
So there'd be, she essentially guaranteed there'd be no spill on River Wright on the latter side that doesn't have the trap in it. So that should work to attract fish to that side.
That'd be nice.
But I have to write up a formal operating plan for that. Before it can get approved. Lance is going to look at it hard, and that has to happen before July, because the earliest we'll start is July. And that's it seems to me, based on the last 8 years of records, I showed it at the last hatchery management team meeting. It seems unlikely we'll be handling any fish in July. It can happen, mm-hmm. but it just seems unlikely. It doesn't happen that often that mm-hmm. that the wild fish count drops early in July. It usually happens late in July.
Okay. Do you know how much she was planning on trying to lock that gate open, or what that looks like?
No, she just described it as some spill. So you can lock it open a notch, I guess.
Yeah.
And then that doesn't put the motor under pressure, so there's no wear on it. It's just locked open so that there's constant spill through that one side.
It'd be nice to get an idea of what that looked like, or how many feet open that was.
I think, I bet it was real similar to what we had when they were repairing.
Yeah.
Back in January, you know, they just opened it. Big issue is how much water's in the lake. In some years, mm-hmm. that would be a lot of water. This year probably isn't going to be very much.
Yeah. Well, it's better than nothing.
Maybe it'll rain.
Maybe. All right. Anything else on Lieberg trapping? Seems like we can take that one off the action items as well.
No, the second one you can. I've still got to get a draft operations plan. So the first Lieberg trapping has to stay on there, and I just got to get it done.
What date do we want to put on there? Or do you want to put on there?
The next hatchery management team meeting.
Okay. Great.
Setting the bar high.
It's not, we've been doing it for 10 years. It's just writing it down.
Having a record. All right, moving on. 2.6. Mackenzie unsanctioned fish releases. This is another item farther down on the agenda, so I think we'll save the discussion until then.
There's not much discussion. They're sanctioned and they're gone.
They're gone?
Yeah.
Released?
Yeah, we got the guidance instructions from the judge on Friday, and they're gone. They went into the river on
Monday
morning.
On Monday?
Before Burns' first email asked him what happened to him. They were already in the river.
Really?
They waited until Monday morning to put them out.
Hmm.
You should have that judge's decision. Right?
I do have the decision, yeah, but I didn't know that fish were released.
Oh, that was the decision.
Oh.
Yeah.
Hmm. Well, we may have some legal issues there.
Not us.
Because
the
guidance that...
Your agreement was 360 with the
exactly.
The litigants.
Yeah.
I knew that was an issue.
So the guidance that I received from our office of counsel is that for federally funded fish, the Corps is only able to release 360,000 into the Mackenzie. And that's federally funded fish. And so all the fish that were at Mackenzie were federally funded.
Yes.
Yeah, you need to circle back around with your legal counsel given the order that went down on Friday.
Yeah, they reviewed that order, Lance. They reviewed it on Friday, and then we got further guidance on Monday, and that's what they're telling us.
Did they also receive that notice that we were releasing fish on the 16th, right?
I can't confirm that.
Okay, that was part of the legal proceedings also. So it was in there.
Interesting.
Circle around with them. That's what you need to do.
Well, we'll see what they say now. Because I don't think they were aware that fish were released.
They
may change it.
They should have. If they missed it, then that would be a little unusual because it was pretty black and white.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Well, that's that.
I think you can take that one off the list.
Finally. All right. 2.7. Cougar releases into Little Fall Creek. John, you said you were going to remind Steve Marks that his decision is needed.
No, that's wrong, and I changed that in the minutes too. It's not Cougar releases into Little Fall Creek, it's Dexter releases.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
It's just down below Dexter.
That's right. Sorry, that's a typo.
And I didn't get an answer back. Jeff, have you talked to Steve about that?
Yeah. No, we're actually, I talked to Lance a little bit about it, and then we talked to the Forest Service, and we have developed a rough plan on moving the unmarked fish into Little Fall Creek this year.
But that's good to go, correct?
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, really?
Yeah.
Awesome.
I thought that's what
okay.
it was, but I didn't have a hard written document saying we were going to do that.
Okay.
There were no objections to it.
And is ODFW going to provide transport for those fish, or are we going to try to share it between some
Forest
of the Willamette Valley?
Is providing the transport.
Who is?
The U.S. Forest Service. Doug Larson's group.
Okay, U.S. Forest Service
really?
Will provide the tank and transport?
No, they're providing the transport, the people for the transport. What vehicle we use is still up in the air.
Hmm.
So we're trying to find a tank and trying to figure out what truck they can pull that tank with, or if they have to borrow one of ours or whatever. So there's still some details to be worked out.
So the Forest Service is going to provide personnel,
right.
but we'll collaborate on a truck and tank.
Right.
How big a tank do you need?
It depends. You know, the biggest number of fish that came back to the trap unmarked that they worked, I think, was 35 last year, something like that. But most of the time it was, you know, 10 or less. And we may make multiple trips also because it's a fairly short turnaround from Dexter up to Little Fall Creek and back.
My question is, would a 400-gallon tank be big enough?
That would be really good.
So we've transported 20 adult fish from Willamette Falls to Corvallis in a 300-gallon tank with no problems. No problems.
Yeah, 400 gallon would be great.
Okay, now the next question that comes up. Greg?
They can have a 1,000-gallon truck from Bandon and Rock Creek.
Yeah, well, what about the one on the trailer you've got?
Well, if we could schedule dates, that would be fine. We just use it for our high lake stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I was thinking is that if the timing was right, because you'll probably be done with your high lake stuff by the time we start moving fish.
Yeah, the only problem with that one tank, it's got a big major baffle in the middle, and it's only got a 4-inch outlet.
Well,
so you'd have to net fish in and net fish out. There's a big baffle right in the middle, unless you wanted to cut that out, but it gives a, you know, it makes it rigid on the sides is more why they put it there.
Okay, okay. Mm-hmm. But the 1,000-gallon one we sent down to Bandon has no baffles in it, so that would work pretty good.
But it needs an 8-inch outlet.
A 12-inch outlet.
Oh, okay, perfect.
They're not using it?
Well, they're using it. We're using that to replace the one that was wrecked from Rock Creek right now, but it's right now they're busy. But in another 2 months, we've got other trucks down there. Things slow down.
That is great news. Okay, I had not heard that had been approved. So that,
yeah.
I mean, I've been all over the Dexter data because I'm writing up the 2014 report now. There's no good news that happened with all those fish that went back to the river. So, on the other hand, what's Fall Creek, Little Fall Creek, going to be like this year? Damn.
A
trickle. Comes out of the old Cascades. It could be pretty low compared to most years.
Hey, Jeff, what was the maximum number of fish that you wanted over there?
I think we were looking at 120. And we'll probably get more than that back to the trap. If I think we had, 240 last year or something like that?
Unclipped fish? Yeah, about that.
Yeah. But, you know, a lot of those are probably mismarks and actual hatchery fish. But, we're not going to be able to make that determination. We'll just bring over what we think is appropriate number and cap it. Yeah. All good.
Yeah, so that would leave some fish in other places too. That would be good for kind of spreading the risk.
Sure. And the, you know, the Forest Service is they're doing a lot to help us out here, and but there's going to be times when they're not going to be available also. So, you know, those will be times when we'll go, well, okay, we'll put them somewhere else this time.
Great. Well, that's awesome. They can help us out.
Yeah.
So you guys will
coordinate. Does anybody have any issues with this?
Not from the Corps.
What are you thinking? We won't have an HGMP in place. They can't be taken into broodstock. They can't be outplanted above lookout. They either go back
in. I'm comfortable with it. I was just wanting to see if anybody else had any concerns.
No, I think it's a very positive move forward based on what happened last year.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I think it's the best option we have. Great, so you guys will coordinate when the time comes to use that truck?
Right.
In Rock Creek, you said?
We'll find one.
Okay.
There's trucks out there anymore existing.
Come out of the woodwork and need one.
Fill me in on what I need to know about the truck from Rock Creek.
It's an automatic 1,000-gallon fiberglass tank. Has two recirc pumps and oxygen. It doesn't have any refrigeration.
But it's a full truck?
Yeah. It's basically a automatic flatbed with the fiberglass 1,000-gallon tank on the back.
Okay. And it takes a CDL to run it, of course.
Correct. And it has a stinger on the back that, you know, we've got about an 8-foot PVC extension for a stinger on it.
Okay.
Are you sure about that CDL, Greg? John's shaking his head in the room here.
That's under 26,000 gross vehicle weight, isn't it?
Depends on if you put water in it or not. I'll let you guys figure that out. We have CDL.
Fish, water, what part aren't you getting?
Because, Jeff, I would imagine if it takes a CDL, that might complicate things with the Forest Service.
Exactly. That's we were actually counting on using a trailer so that we could get... So that we didn't have to worry about who was had a CDL and who didn't with the Forest Service.
Exactly.
But that truck could be used for something else, like... go ahead.
Yeah, my rental fee isn't too high.
All right. You guys will coordinate internally.
We'll find something. We'll find a tank.
All right, great.
I mean, I was just touching two of them on Monday down in Southwest, and now that we have both regions combined, that doesn't mean I can't steal them from the road where they're from.
Sure. Awesome.
We'll find them.
Okay, unless there's any further discussion, we'll take that one off.
I would like to add one thing, is that if you can find a one-ton pickup truck with a 300-gallon tank, that'll handle 90% of the day's travels and be a hell of a lot easier than a 1,000-gallon tank with one fish in it.
Well, I know there's a tank at Leeburg on a trail.
Hey, you guys, this is Doug from the Corps. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
We have a 300-gallon tank on a trailer with two aerators and oxygen, supplemental oxygen. That would be available if somebody could come up with a pickup truck.
Cool.
Great.
We got way too many tanks.
Hey, John, where was that 400-gallon trailer?
Well, that Greg owned a trailer and a truck.
Okay.
That's
400 gallons of slip tank. It just slips into the back of a truck.
Yeah. Got it. Okay.
And I know there's that trailer mounted tank at Leeburg too, besides two trucks.
How big an opening does that have, Greg?
Ours, it's only a 6-inch. It's just for the fingerlings we put up in the high legs.
Okay. So it wouldn't
net them into the top and the bottom.
Out.
Yeah, it's not good for adults.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Hey, Doug, is that 300-gallon one built for adults?
Yeah, it is, and maybe it's again his trailer mounted. We used it in the past, remember, to take those marked fish from Fall Creek over to over there.
Okay.
It worked. It was pretty slick. You know, about 12, 13 fish maximum.
Sure.
At the average Willamette Springer weight density.
All right. I'm going to hold you to that.
Yeah, it's not doing anything but collecting sparrows.
Okay, thanks.
Great. Any further discussion on that one? All right. 2.8, adult release sites. So this was my action to report back to the group about potential improvements. We identified two holes within the basin that would not work, and one is on the North Santiam main stem. We don't really have a good release site there. Cooper's Ridge is not going to work, obviously. And so it'd be nice to have a spot there. And also, Cam pointed out that South Fork McKenzie, it'd be nice to have a spot that's a little bit higher than that sub-basin. So I took a look at some of those locations. For folks that are on the web meeting, I'm going to throw up a PowerPoint that has some pictures on it. So hopefully you can see this. Went out with Greg Grimberger on the North Santiam and looked at a couple potential sites. And this site has a beautiful, beautiful pool. It's a perfect location. It's called the Lower Log Deck. And it's really, it's like half a river mile up from Cooper's Ridge. And I believe this was considered by the original PDT when they looked at sites, but they decided to get rid of it because it involves maybe some kind of agreement with a private landowner. And whoever from the Corps was working this didn't want to deal with that headache, whatever it may be. And it might be more of a challenge to get some kind of agreement in place, but it really wouldn't take much. I don't think we have to build anything here. We might have to improve an old skid road, which would mean regrading it and maybe some gravel and like some minor tree trimming. But I talked with Elise Kelly about this site, and she's willing to work with me. It might be easier for the state in some cases to have an agreement with the private landowner. And it's actually Marion Forks Investment Inc. that owns this little spit of land. And it's maybe, I don't know, a couple hundred yards of road that we would have to repair. So really minimal costs. And what we could do at this location is set up a temporary pipe, like what we've done at the Brightonwood Hot Springs, which is what Greg was doing, and just temporarily set up that pipe for a couple of weeks, go and outplant fish in this location. When we're done, pull the pipe, and there's no impact to the landowner there. This is a picture of that old skid road and what it looks like. So it's pretty much there, and it's weird. It's kind of like a road to nowhere. It basically goes straight into where this hole is, more or less. So,
and I'm not sure it wasn't an old rainbow release site.
Yeah, it could have been back.
And I'm not sure why that road was there, other than it dead ends at that little hole.
Yeah. So, any thoughts, concerns about this location?
This looks great. What's the gradient from the roadbed to the water surface?
Greg, I was thinking maybe like 3 feet, maybe a 4 foot drop.
Perfect.
Maybe 4 or 5 at the very most.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure you could find a better location.
Awesome.
It's perfect.
You get a truck in, the gradient, it would only be about a 10, maybe 12 foot pipe. Pretty easy if we can get the Marion Forks Investment Corp to get on. And we kind of have a relationship with Miles, who runs that, so I think that if we, Elise wants to take the lead and start working with that,
So the next step would basically be to have some kind of informal meeting, probably with Elise, Greg, myself, and this guy Miles, that's the landowner, see if he's amenable to this idea. If he is, proceed from there. So yeah, keep you guys updated on that one. We looked at another site, which is much higher in the basin. This is off of Parrish Lake Road. And apparently we used to outplant fish here, not too many, like 18 or 20 pairs. This picture was taken just like 2 weeks ago. You can see kind of in the right-hand corner, there's a pretty decent pool This is looking upstream off the Parrish Lake Road Bridge. This is looking downstream, another pretty nice pool. And Greg was telling me that flows right now, because this is such a low water year, are actually more typical of maybe August, September time frame. So I think on normal water years when we have adequate flow, this location is another good potential. On years like this one, where we have really low flows, the site might be too dry to outplant fish. There just might not be enough of a pool, and then might not be enough habitat there. And this is above where rainbows are stocked as well, so there shouldn't really be any fishing activity up here, and if there is, then it's pretty obvious poaching. And so we did decide to outplant fish
miles
here.
Miles above the hatchery.
Yeah, yeah, a couple miles above the hatchery. And upstream and downstream in this area, like 3 miles of pretty good habitat. The cool thing about this site is that it basically already has a road almost down into the pool.
Wow.
There's a section of riprap there. You can see in that picture where we could, again, do some kind of temporary pipe anchored into that riprap with some T-posts, just like we did at Brighton Bush Hot Springs, and outplant fish there for a couple of weeks when we need it.
Is that the highway?
No, that's Parrish Lake Road. The highway is behind me in that picture.
Oh, okay. Only about a quarter mile, a third of a mile back. It's not too far off the highway.
Where did that road go? I mean, is it?
I don't know. I don't even. It looks like it was built for us. Yeah.
That's not paved very far down that road, is it, Greg?
No, you can see
but it's hard and gravel. They put that road in there to put the riprap, and they rebuilt this bridge 2 years ago. So they put that little spur road in there, I think, to just get cement into the footings and then put the riprap in.
It sounds like this is another.
How many miles above the hatchery did you say it was, Greg?
Big Meadows is about 12, and this is probably 2 miles below Big Meadows. It's somewhere between about 8 and 10, probably. And we used to put fish here years ago. We'd put about 10 or 12 pair in there, maybe a little more, late August, just so they go in there and spawn and give some stream nutrient enrichment. And then they started doing this rebuild of this bridge and the culverts. It used to be a much bigger, deeper hole before they redid this bridge. But I think it offers a lot of habitat, both upstream towards Big Meadows and then downstream. And I think fish here have any idea that there's a hatchery below, so I think they would probably want to continue upriver. There's no hatchery smell, obviously, up there. So.
Hey, Lance, do you remember if this site, when it was used in the past, if there was any reason we stopped putting fish here, or anybody for that matter?
Yeah, Greg would know.
Yeah, we basically stopped because they were talking about redoing this bridge and the culvert, and they were telling us there really wouldn't be a highway there. And then there was discussion on maybe just, you know, putting them in lower at the reservoir and letting fish go above. But I think kind of since then we've just decided that, you know, the fish stop at Marion Creek or Horn Creek most of the time. So I'm really not sure why we stopped. I think it was kind of towards the end of when Mr. Momoyak was retiring, and maybe we just didn't pick it back up.
All right.
Yeah, I think it works for a short term, you know, when we're still using hatchery fish, but over the long term, I mean, we want the fish to weed themselves out as they want to, so. And it's pretty skinny up there, if I remember right. I mean, it's pretty low flow, right?
This is, like Andy said, usually it's about what August looks like. Usually this time of year, that thing's probably twice that big, but and like I said, we put them in late in the year just because it is a little skinny. But I know doing snorkel surveys up there a couple of times, we saw fish at least a mile or two above that. And this is way above. We kind of liked it because it's way above the rainbow stocking. So basically, there's some natural cutthroat and a few natural rainbow, but not a lot of predatory fish.
One benefit to this site is, depending on what happens this year, we can start using it now. We could use it tomorrow if we needed to, and we don't need to build anything. But my thought is that we would probably evaluate, based on what the water year is, if this site would be acceptable to outplant fish. when the time comes in August or September. If it is, great. Let's use it if folks are agreeable to it. And if not, then we'll pass on it. Does anyone have serious concerns about not using this site? Okay. So
just be kind of what we thought the numbers or carrying capacity would be up there, and yeah. What time of year would we want to put them there?
Right. And is that something that we would want to reflect on the disposition sheet, or is a small site that's kind of included in?
Do we get that specific?
No, we don't. We don't narrow it down to individual release locations.
Okay.
We could note.
It'd be interesting to have a record of it somewhere.
Absolutely. So we're still planning on pit tagging all of the fish we outplant. Mm-hmm. And then we're recovering pretty good carcass recovery rates in the North San Diego last year.
Yeah.
Probably really good this year with shell water. So we'd be able to say things like, Greg, I'm not sure. If you put fish above the hatchery, I'm inclined to believe some of them are going to fall back because it doesn't smell good to them anymore. That's a guess, but we'd be able to track that. Yeah.
I'd like to know that. Obviously, we saw that with early releases in the Brighton Bush that one year. So,
yeah,
you know, that's why I think we kind of put them up there in late August because they're, you know, pretty close to spawning.
Yeah, we see that in the Middle Fork or the North Fork also. If we put them up there, the earlier we put them up there, the higher the chance they'll end up in Salt Creek or Salmon Creek down by the hatchery. Hmm.
Yeah. Cool. All right, well, do we want to say that we'll plan on using the site then, going forward?
Yeah, and I'd like to say that it's a late outplant site.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great. So, South Fork, McKenzie. This is up by the Frizzell Bridge. There's a campground up there, right next to where that bridge crosses the river. And apparently this site was also looked at with a much larger group a couple years ago when they were investigating these, and then for some reason dropped off the radar. Again, this is a little bit lower water year. There's not as great of pools through this area, but there is some slower and some deeper moving water through here that would work to outplant fish into, and is obviously a whole lot better than dropping them off the bridge like we're doing currently. So it's going to be an improvement here. So the downside to these sites is that they are in a campground. This campground sees pretty significant traffic earlier in the summer, decreasing more towards the end of August and September. But there's a couple of campsites that could be just slightly modified that basically back right up to the river. This is the first one, and all we'd really have to do is move the picnic table and then move a couple of the boulders that are in the background there. And then what we'd want to do is probably install a fence with a gate so that when the truck is ready to come in, we could unlock that gate back in through there, but still prevent regular vehicle access into that campground.
So you're thinking of this for the release of hatchery fish from McKenzie Hatchery, or both cougar and McKenzie? Because my sense of it is that the cougar releases, and Doug, weigh in on this, okay? You can put them anywhere in the river, and they'll self-distribute because they're born up there. Mm-hmm. It's the hatchery releases which will only occur late because we can't do that until we know what we need to supplement to get to our escapement.
Right.
That'll be two times a year. Maybe mm-hmm. twice a year we'll take a truck up there and access that. I wouldn't invest a heck of a lot if we're just going to make two trips up there.
Yeah.
Where are the cougar fish released now?
Down low at
Homestead.
Homestead, I think it's called.
Yeah. Which is a site that our core truck can use because it's four-wheel drive, mm-hmm. but the ODFW truck can't use it because it's a pretty big cobbly beach right there.
Right.
That's hard to back into.
You guys are talking about Hard Rock, right?
Hard Rock, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What's your sense on it? Because the way I'm thinking about it is that the cougar outplant operation is fine as long as you get them into running water. They're going to go where they were born.
Yep.
To get the hatchery fish to spawn, we have to put them up there late ready to drop cargo up high, and then they won't just fall back into the reservoir and be gone.
Yeah, and that's what I was kind of talking about with folks and in looking at this site with Mike Hoganson and with Kurt, and they were kind of thinking, yeah, this might be a good place to put hatchery fish, almost keep them away a little bit from some of the wild fish that are up there, but...
Sure.
It's a site...
Yeah, the other advantage is that it's above... I might be a disadvantage this year, but it's above Roaring River, and you know, we've seen Chinook on occasion going into Roaring River, which is the bull trout spawning stream, but not very often. And this would be in a little bit warmer water, and hopefully they'd use the water up to Elk Creek there to spawn in.
What's the name of the site? What do you want to call it?
It's the Frizzell Crossing Campground. I don't really think it's...
Hey, Andy, yeah. Is the main point of having the upper release site like this is to get at the issue of distributing Chinook better throughout the South Fork, like above Roaring River, or is it just to have a better release site?
I think it gets at the distribution issue a little bit better, Lance. And so we don't just have release sites that are low in the sub-basin, but ones that are kind of scattered. So we have some low options, we have some high options. And we have, you know, a variety of choices for where we want to put fish. That's what I was kind of thinking of it as.
The release site doesn't look that much better than the rebuilt one that's down below.
Yeah, it's not an ideal location, but right now fish are being dropped off the Frizzell Bridge, which is probably a 15 to 20 foot drop. That's right next to this campground. So this would certainly be an improvement over that, but you're right.
And there are no options upstream from that.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It's not a big, beautiful pool, but it sounds like we don't really have that too often up there.
Well, what's the
What's that?
What's the Forest Service say about this?
I haven't talked to them yet, and that would be kind of the linchpin here is that they need to be willing to let us do a few minor modifications here. Kurt actually had the idea of maybe we reserve that campground for the month of September or for a couple of weeks in September. But I think the impact of the campground itself would be pretty minimal, moving rocks and maybe putting in a fence. And so the benefit here is that we're not building another pipe, another big concrete release structure, which it sounds like the Forest Service has been opposed to in the past because it's a wild and scenic river. So whenever you want to build something, it's a problem. But if we could do another temporary pipe for the 2 weeks or two trips that we're going to take up there, that'd be pretty easy to do.
Can you reach this without without building anything?
I think if you had like a 6 foot or 8 foot flume that came off the back of a lib truck, you wouldn't need anything.
Well, I was kind of thinking is that you can get pretty darn close to the river.
Yeah. And McKenzie Hatchery doesn't have one of those flumes right now, but I know Willamette has a couple. And so that's something we could easily pay for to have an aluminum shop fab up for us.
Andy, it's Doug. That's not an actual campsite where you would be backing into that ripple, is it?
It is an actual campsite. Are you on the web meeting?
I am.
Okay.
Yeah, I know the spot.
Yeah,
I've always thought that was better than free falling them off the bridge, but I was just concerned about the campers.
Yeah, that is definitely a concern here. It's something we'll have to weigh. It does get usage, and there's folks up there for sure. So. Are you looking at the screen right now?
I am.
Okay, so this picture is looking at in between those two trees where we could potentially drop fish. This picture is taken from the exact same location, turned 180 degrees around. So you're looking back out at the main road for the campground.
Yep.
So.
Yeah, I'm kind of sharing what Doug's saying. I mean, the rebuilt site pretty much eliminated that whole camping area for the outplanting, and now we're not going to use it, and now we're asking for more. You might weigh that whole scene. That's not good.
Yeah, I agree. It's definitely a concern. And I'm not saying this is what we have to go with. These are just some options that I've discovered. Do you guys think that potential poaching or you know, having the public there is too big of an issue? We can look for something else. But in talking with Kurt and with Mike Hogensen, who seemed to know that basin pretty darn well, these are the best options they could come up with. Jeff, do you have any other potential ideas?
No, there's for being that high up, we looked at this one extensively and figured that we could get a truck in there, and it was a better option than, like you say, putting them off the bridge. But
right.
I don't know of any other good access points up there.
Are the other campsites right next to this one? I mean, it looked...
They're fairly dispersed. There's probably, I don't know, 50 yards in between each one. Maybe a little less in some cases.
Just wondering, if you pulled a truck in there to release fish, are people going to be standing right there watching, or are they far enough away that they might not realize what's going on?
I don't know.
I think they'll notice. They'll know what's going on.
The big ODFW sticker on the side. Yeah.
Hey.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to that's this digital connection. And if it means anything, you guys, we interrupt campers at Hard Rock. I mean, we literally back past the tent. I just wanted to put that out there to maybe warn people.
We could put up a sign at that site and even put where we expect to run the truck through and ask people not to put their tent there.
Yeah, the general consensus has been support and in excitement. Yeah. People are really interested in it.
There's two really good sites in this campground, and one of them is at the very beginning of the campground. It's like the first campsite. And the other one is kind of in the back of the campground. It's the very last site, so you could drive, I don't know if it's better or worse, drive all the way through the campground, but then get away from where everyone else is. So, I don't know if one would be preferable to the other, but it's not right in the middle of the campground, at least.
What we've had the camp hosts do at Hard Rock is just warn the campers and show them kind of where the truck goes, and really the campers have been supportive.
Is there a camp host here in September?
It didn't look like there was one place for one here. This is pretty...
I have no idea. I don't either.
Okay.
Maybe it's worth having an initial conversation with the Forest Service about it.
Yep.
That's what I thought.
Get their feel on it.
I was going to talk to Ray and see what he thinks.
Because if they're going to say no anyway, then...
Yeah.
There's a couple people that work for American Vending, which is the contractor, and we've been relying on them to inform the campers at Hard Rock. But again, that's just one or two campsites, a small area there.
All right. Any other thoughts on adult release sites?
North Santa Yam looks like you can take that off the list. That looks really good.
Yeah, I'm going to keep pursuing the lower log deck one, see if we can get the state to help us out with an agreement with the landowner. Okay. South Fort McKenzie, we'll talk to the Forest Service and see if they'd be willing.
Yep.
All right. Great. Okay, 2.9, Steelhead Work Group. Dave, I think, tentatively scheduled this with you, John, for March 25th. If you wanted to reserve one of these rooms.
Yeah, and then nobody could show.
No one could show.
Well, I reserved it, and then we got feedback that I warned him that it was spring break.
And
that's why we don't have these meetings during spring break. And,
right.
And so we're going to have to move it to another date.
Okay.
That's where we're going right now.
So we'll put that as an action for Dave to reschedule.
We were going to get the Steelhead Draft HGMP from Pevin before that. That would be now. We're not getting it now?
No, I think we can. From what I've heard, that's ready, and either he was going to present it at that workshop, but it'd probably be more beneficial to have something to look at it.
Yeah, I'd like to see
a couple weeks beforehand.
Even today. I mean,
well, that's maybe it's beneficial that next week now is canceled. So if we get it, just, then you have 2 or 3 weeks to look at.
Yeah, can, we get, can I make that request? Can we get it? If it's available, may we have the draft Steelhead HGMP from Pevin and Keith now, soon?
I will see if it's available. If it is...
Do you want that task, or do you want Linhart?
Linhart, please. Be great, since he's not here yet.
Not here.
Yeah. He's been driving it for a while, so I'll let him lay it up.
Where is he today?
I think he had a doctor's appointment.
Oh, okay.
He said he's going to be calling in around now, between now and 11.
Okay. So next Wednesday, the 25th, that meeting will not happen?
That's correct. That will not happen. From what I understand. All right, moving along to updates. Marion Forks and Minto.
You're up. All right. Up at Marion Forks, everything's going well. We're plotting our Chinook outside from the starter troughs inside. Obviously plotted in late January, and we're still about 5 weeks ahead of normal. We're generally just pulling the fry out of the incubators now, but they're about 600-700 a pound and going outside. Fish health wise, they're doing real well. Other than that, we just converted all the snow equipment over to lawn mowing stuff and are mowing lawns. So our hope for a late snow, I don't think, is going to happen. Down at Minto, we released our second and final group of Chinook smolts on Sunday and Monday. We just tried to take advantage of that rain we had and a little bit of a flow increase for winter steelhead on the north. About 90% of the fish were out the first day, and there's just a few scattered ones in there today. They moved out real well. They ended up being about 10.3 on an average fish per pound, which for us is a pretty good size. They look good. They're smolting well and left quickly. The mergansers and otters are very thankful for that. But anyway, other than that, we're rolling along here at Minto.
All right.
The good news is Willamette actually did muddy up. So once they got through the North Santiam, maybe they didn't get eaten quite so badly.
Yeah, we got some side channels down by Mahama that were fairly muddy too. We were going to wait another week or two, but thought this was a good opportunity. On the winter steelhead side, we have 15 total. As of last Friday, we had 2. So far this week, we've collected 13 more. Kind of skewed though. We have 13 males and 2 females. Not sure if it's just a coincidence or something, but anyways, genetic samples were taken and they were passed above Minto.
All right. Thanks, Greg. South Santiam, Brett.
The hatchery, we just spotted our summer steelhead this month, our fry, and having a little higher loss than normal, but anyway, I think we have pathology out looking them out at them today, but other than that, they're feeding well. Our spring Chinook fry, look, your fingerlings now, they look good. This is the first year we started Chinook out here, and shaping up looks like something that we'll be able to do. We stocked about our summer steelhead smolts, so we're kind of changed our game plan a little on those this release period. So we're working on that. We just released the last group of Chinook smolts that we acclimated from Willamette this week. And then we also began work on getting the parts ordered to replace that plumbing for the hatch house that you looked at.
Oh yeah, nice.
And we're also working with ODF&W Engineering to start work on spending that R&E grant that we received to get the new header pipe installed on the new adult rearing, the old adult rearing pond, new or adult holding pond, new rearing pond, whatever, we haven't quite named it yet. And then as far as foster goes, the maintenance crew over there have been doing some work and replacing a few of the guards over some of the troubled areas on some of the moving equipment, and we are continuing to run the trap, kind of checking it several times a week. So far we have 19 winters and 1 summer, and the only thing that we have had a couple fish jump out of the pre-sort, so I'm going to have to start looking at seeing what we're going to do. I guess we're going to have to cover that pond, so, or that pre-sort pool. So that's kind of the only big issue we're coming up on there.
Any mortalities from fish jumping out?
Yeah. We just had Benton came across one, so we need to go over and look at it and see what it is. The last one was an older summer, but need to go get an ID on this new one.
Have you seen what they have at the cougar pre-sort pool?
No.
You might want to hook up with Doug or Greg or some of those guys, because they've got a nice little, you can probably describe it better than I can, Doug, but a nice little mesh covering that they can string over the top of that thing when they're not using it.
I can send you all a picture if you like.
Okay.
It's just a sunshade.
Yeah, we'll get on that start tomorrow, go over there and start taking some measurements, and I'll make some contacts and try to get the solution going. But yeah, they're not, just kind of rolling along.
Cool. Thanks.
Yeah.
All right. McKenzie.
You should be on leave.
He's on leave. He's up in the mountains.
Sorry.
Yeah. Well, he's actually, I see, I got the abbreviated report last night. It says I'm not going to be here. So, yeah, he's on leave. But anyway, so as we discussed earlier, all of Route 13 fish are gone now, either transferred away to some other place or released into the McKenzie. But we reached that 604,000 HGMP number. When that, and our production, of course, is aligned to that.
Right.
Yeah.
You guys get here?
Pardon me?
Yeah. In Lowell. How about across the street from the high school? You'll see an old Forest Service building.
You got to put your phone on.
Hey, Doug, mute your phone.
Go up the hill, and you'll see the high school parked in that pool out right across the street.
Push mute and just mute.
Oh,
I know.
Okay, bye.
So, do you have a couple extras beyond the 604?
604,970.
They hit target, but actually, they hit 605. That's what
okay.
The court directed them to release. And we had consumed everything up to that point, and so they're. Those fish are all gone, and so now no more adjustments. We're on track moving forward, and now the HGMP finalization is the process to get into. Things are working good, and I think the fish are feeding well. The fish health exams have said everything is cool, and then as other mentioned was that you guys have gone up and looked at the Frizzell Crossing release site.
Yeah,
and. that's McKenzie. Everything is fine and good.
Awesome.
So then Leeburg, same thing. The big event is these guys are still recounting their recovery from January with the roll gate problems, but that's all been solved. We've leveled everything out from that. Leeburg is just finishing installation of their automatic feeders. They had to refurbish those, repair them, upgrade them, so that they don't require people to walk up and down the raceway walls with 5-gallon buckets and spend endless hours dipping fish by hand or feed by hand. So, but Leeburg is they've started their trout releases.
Yep.
They're moving, and then everybody that owns a truck driver is loaning truck drivers to haul salmon for a lot of other programs too, non-core programs.
Yeah.
But that SAFE program within the Astoria, everybody is gone. It's real hard to find a truck driver right now. But things are operating pretty smooth.
Great.
That's an ignorant question. Do we have a trout HGMP? I don't deal with it at all, but we must have one, right?
I don't think there. Maybe it's included in something else.
Anybody know? Is there a rainbow trout HGMP? Okay.
We probably should have one.
I should. I don't know.
If we have, if you get a list of fish somewhere.
What's the question?
Is there a rainbow trout planter trout HGMP?
Yes, there is. Probably outdated now because it hasn't been looked at in many years, but one exists.
Alright.
Do you still have a spare tire? I haven't seen it in 20 years.
I assume it's still there. Alright. Anything else on the
No, that's good. That's good.
Cool, great. Hey, Doug, as far as the cougar trap goes, you guys decided on a start date?
Yeah, we're going to be opening on Thursday.
Okay.
So, as usual, we'll probably see a few bull trout early before the salmon come.
It's tomorrow?
Yeah.
And we opened Fall Creek yesterday, and immediately it's full of winter steelhead.
Full of being two? Eight? How many?
Okay, put it this way. Five or eight on the surface, which means double it.
Double
or whatever.
Great. How about Willamette?
Hold on, quick question.
Right.
Do you DNA sample the steelhead?
Yes. I've got records for several years and clips and all that. Yep, we're just doing that for posterity.
What happens to those specimens?
They stack up in my office on the shelf.
Okay.
In vials. So yeah, we're hoping to run them. Excuse me.
So one of the things we're trying to push forward this year is renewing the contract for the life history project, Chinook Life History, including a DNA archive for all the Chinook DNA samples we've been taking forever, but. We really need a way, an archive for the DNA samples, too, and that I'd like to adopt steelhead into that. But the storage of DNA samples is different from storage of scales.
We've been collecting the basic morphometrics and then the samples and the ethanol, so we should probably have a meeting about all that, what to do with those samples.
Right.
I think Mike Hogan's been getting, I think Chad's been handing them off to Mike Hogan, at least the older ones. So Mike would be the best person as far as tracking the older samples down, actually.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
All right, moving on to Willamette and Dexter. Dan, are you still on the line?
Yeah, I'm still here. Dexter, we've got two more releases of Chinook and one, our summer steelhead, still to go out. The third group of Chinook will go out next week. Probably try to hopefully get a little moisture and we'll let them go then. As far as Willamette, everything's good. Like Greg said, the fish are 5 to 6 weeks ahead of schedule. And they're getting big. This is the first year that we've ever had to hold our fry back. We actually have got them on schedules now, or they're going to be way too big for marking. Rainbow, we started our rainbow libs, and other than that, we're just doing maintenance stuff, getting ready for marking here and adult work. We did do a group of summer steelhead this year. We got eggs from Brett, and they're doing great. They're already at 400 to the pound, which is way ahead of what Oak Springs can get them at this time of the year. Mm. So hopefully, if everything goes as it is right now, we're going to do all our own summer steelhead instead of using Oak Springs starting next year.
Cool.
Hey, Dan. Why,
yeah.
Why are your fish ahead of Oak Springs fish? What did you do differently?
We got the early eggs from Brett, and then our water temperatures are warmer than their spring. So we're using our well, which is a constant 54 degrees.
Oh, okay.
So as soon as we got those eggs, they were on 54 degree water.
Okay.
Cool. Anything else, Dan?
Nope, that's it.
All right, thank you. Fish counts at Bennett and Lieberg.
I'm sending them around. Nothing unusual or weird.
Yeah.
Right. That's it. Everything's going well.
Yeah.
Everybody's getting those? Who wants those for now? Greg is now on the distribution list.
I'm not getting the ones from Lieber.
Neither am I.
I don't recall seeing them myself.
I'll talk to Hoagie.
And I wouldn't mind seeing the Bennett ones at the same time.
I have been getting those. All right, moving along. Kinsey Fish releases, done, already talked about. Cougar Adult Trap Operations. This is kind of a rollover from last month. Jeff gave proposed some of his ideas and things he's been thinking about, and we thought about it, and
thought about it some more. Haven't actually worked on it much since the last time.
Right.
I did have one question, though, about the trap. Does that thing, is there a return pipe back to the tail race?
Doug?
Sorry, guys, I'm learning this BlackBerry. Yes, there is. We have a recovery tank and then a pipe that goes to the tail race from that recovery tank.
Okay. So that was another thing that we were thinking about was, how would we handle some of those fish? We didn't want to actually truck them. Were there some options of maybe just returning them to the tail race and seeing if they come back up again? So just thinking about options.
Yeah, it's pretty gentle. We can observe them, recover them fully, and observe them.
Okay.
Yep.
Jeff, how do you want to proceed with that one moving forward? Should we keep this on the agenda?
I'd keep it on the agenda. I haven't. I want to get with Cam a little bit more and talk about it and see what we're still kind of waiting on that genetic data from 2014 too. So
right.
That's once we get that, I think we'll have a lot better idea where we want to go.
I think so too. So do you want to have an action for next month to update us, or do you want to take this off the agenda and then talk about it when you're ready?
Well, why don't we have I think the action item would be to talk about the genetic data and then this.
Yeah, when that's available.
Right.
Okay.
What's the status of that?
It's later on the agenda.
Yeah.
That's where it is. Okay.
14 samples. And I don't really have anything about that. I've asked multiple people. I believe it sits with Dave Griffith as far as funding those things. I believe we do have funding. That's kind of what I heard, but I need to confirm with Dave. I haven't been able to get a hold of him.
He's been really, really hard with his new appointment.
He's on one of those fancy core detail things where they go and pretend they're somebody else for a while. So
he sort of told me to go ahead and deal with Brad.
Okay.
Because unless somebody has been assigned a particular project of his.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody has. I know Dave has. I talked to him.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just correspond with Brad now. And CC Griff.
That's probably
smart. And if he gets mad at me, he can get mad at me.
Yeah. So I'll keep nailing him too. But
how long will it actually take to have those samples read?
Remind me how many there were.
Not
80? No. That was just females. So probably under 200.
That's what I was thinking.
Each.
So, this is Mark, Jeff. I'm on the line.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, guys. So, the genetic analyses could probably be done in, I'd say, a few months, 3 months. Maybe shorter. So, it involves extracting the DNA, running the genotypes, cleaning those up, and then, of course, there's some that don't amplify the first time, so you rerun them. And then the analyses, which take a bit of time, actually. Using the software that we're using, it's pretty computationally intensive because we're, assigning only 100 or whatever it is, adults, but we're assigning them to a large number of potential parents, and so all of those genotypes have to be included in analyses, and it chews up quite a lot of computer time Sometimes we can run that software. It takes weeks before we get the output with the computer running all the while.
Is there a way that we can get the samples started up there? Or is it, I mean, it sounds like everybody was in agreement that it's going to get done. It's just a matter of getting the paperwork through? Or is that a bad assumption?
Well, I mean, I think the hang-up is funding for the analyses. So, you know, it costs money to do this work.
Andy, fill in the blanks for us.
I wish I could, Jeff. like I said before, Dave Griffith was the one who was on this project. He was the lead. He was going to be securing funding. And Dave took a temporary job assignment elsewhere in the Corps. And so, as far as we know, no one else has picked up that ball. So I know Cam has talked to Brad Eppert.
They just sent an email to him.
Oh,
he hasn't responded or anything like that.
I sent an email to Griff 2 days ago asking about the same thing. So we'll keep hammering whoever to get an answer on this. But for right now, I don't know.
Hey, this is Dave. I just got on the phone. Apologize for being so late. But is there a imminent time issue that we're dealing with this particular study? I know. That it is on Griff's plate, and I know he has not dropped it, but is there something we need to do to really expedite things, or am I missing something?
Well, yeah, I guess what we were looking at was we needed that data to
be analyzed
before July 1 was the date that we were considering, and so if we don't have that information by July 1, then we have to come up with a different alternative.
Okay, then that's good to know. Thanks. I knew there was a time frame. I couldn't remember what it was, but
it sounds to me from the from what Mark just said is we're pressing that July 1 deadline right now.
Excuse me. Yeah. Okay. I just got on the phone. So after this meeting, I'll go hunt down Griff and I'll talk to him and I'll get back to you guys one way or the other with what's going on.
Jeff, so I would only add, I mean, if we were to really fast track these, I would still say 2 months just to make things reasonable in the lab.
Okay, that's good to know.
And be able to provide confidence, you know. We can get an answer, you know, with a little more time, the accuracy of the answer. We have more confidence in that. So I would say 2 months on the short and 3 months would be longer. The other thing to keep in mind here for Dave is that, you know, these folks need to be able to schedule their time, too. So,
Right. I was worried about it.
Okay. They're doing other things, not just this. And so
right.
Just as with all of us, it's, just because an emergency is dropped on your lap doesn't mean you can work it in. But they need to have a heads up.
So it sounds like if we can't secure the funding piece by the beginning of April, we might be too late to do anything about it this year. Would that be correct?
That could be a possibility, yeah.
Okay. So we'll see what we can do about getting it done before then. Hopefully we can. I will continue to talk to Griff and Brad and whoever, as will Dave and Cam, and see what we can do there. Anything else on number 5?
Not from here.
All right. Great. So, Dave, now that you're on, and I saw that Ryan joined the online meeting,
move on
to number 6, some of the comments on the PNNL report.
Yeah. I'll start the conversation, then let Ryan jump in. But there were some circumstances that occurred late last year, as a result of which I lost about 6 weeks of time between having surgery and the holidays, just literally lost about 6 weeks. So we were running out of time on the PNNL contract. It was ending, and so I was in haste just to get a report out to you guys, which isn't our normal procedure, but I was able to work with PNNL, and Ryan Harnish was kind enough to literally offer at his own time and I'm not going to talk about money, but his own time, he's gone back and looked through all of ODF&W's comments, and we appreciate getting those comments, Bernadette and others, and he has put a written response together for all of them. We're going to send that out here probably in a day or so, but I got Ryan on the phone for us so that he could just walk through each one of the comments and then the response that he is proposing to add to send out a new report, but I can't guarantee that because, like I said, there is no contract in place anymore, and I can't ask folks to work when there's no contract or money. Or we'll just simply append this to the back and then resend it out. But with that in mind, I'm going to let Ryan go ahead. Unless somebody else has something they'd like to say in the group, I'm going to let Ryan just jump right into the comments. And again, he was nice enough, found some time to be able to respond thoughtfully, I think, to each one of the comments. So if there aren't any other folks that want to say anything, I'm going to let Ryan go ahead.
Dave, question was... the peer review a task included in the contract?
Yeah, it always is. Again, there was circumstances that were outside of my control, and like I said, I lost about 6 weeks. Yeah, we always have. That's part of the, you know, he gives us a draft. We look at it internally. We send it out for regional review, get comments, finalize it, and that's what we do. That's the procedure, always has been. But when suddenly it was the middle of January, I knew his contract was ending. I realized there simply wasn't the time frame, so that's what happened. It won't happen again.
Yeah. So, you know, these were some really good, thoughtful comments, I thought, and so I'm going to make an effort to incorporate these comments and these changes into the report and resubmit it. Be doing that on my own time, but I want it to be, you know, the best possible report that it can be. And I think that some of these comments will make it a better report. So I guess you want me to just read through each of these comments and then my response to them?
Yeah, I mean, if folks are okay with that, either that or if you can try to summarize the comments from ODF&W, not just read them verbatim. It doesn't really matter. We've got time, don't we, Andy?
I was going to say, I don't need you to go through every single comment if you're planning to address them and, you know, update the report. I mean, My concern was that this hadn't been sent out for review, and that was the normal procedure, and we wanted to make sure that our comments were received and hopefully addressed, and it sounds like that's happening. I mean, that to me.
Well, I think Bernadette, there are a number of comments that were made by ODF&W that can be addressed as simply as thank you. We'll clarify that in a document. But I think there are a couple that are technical in nature that I think Ryan should respond to, so folks understand why he did what he did. And I'd really like to go through those.
Sure.
So yeah, maybe let's pull out the big ones. Talk about those.
let's see. I'll scroll through them here.
Well, I think comment two is a good place to start then.
Okay. So under the objectives, we listed 30 days as describing extended periods beyond which we would expect any fish remaining to be residual hatchery steelhead. So the question was, why was the time frame chosen? Is it likely that interactions within 30 days would trigger population level effects, or was this based on study constraints such as tag life? And we selected the 30-day time frame prior to the first year of the study, just under the assumption that the smolts that were going to migrate out of the river would do so within 30 days. The results that we obtained over the 2 years indicated that more than 98% of the fish that did migrate to and were detected at Willamette Falls did so within 30 days. So we feel pretty confident that fish remaining in the river beyond 30 days are most likely residual fish that have the potential for negative ecological effects on wild omicus. The battery life was not an issue there. It was 125 days. In 2014, We didn't actually begin any of our underwater observations or mobile tracking until 50 days after the hatchery fish were released, so we definitely feel confident that fish remaining after 50 days were residuals, and if enough of those are around, we feel like population level effects are possible. If there's no comments there, I'll move on to the next one, which was regarding the detection range of the radio telemetry, the fixed radio telemetry receivers. And so due to funding constraints, we essentially just piggybacked on a University of Idaho study. They already had fixed radio telemetry receivers at various locations in the San Yam and Willamette Rivers. So we used detections of our tags on those receivers to look at the emigration rates of our hatchery, radio tag hatchery steelhead. So therefore, there was no range test done, at least not with the tags used in our study. I've been trying to get a hold of Mark Morash with Low-Tech, who worked with the University of Idaho in deploying and maintaining and downloading those receiver stations, to try to get a sense from him if he thought there would be any issues with the detection range of those receiver stations on our tags. I haven't been able to get a hold of him yet, but I'll continue to try to do that. Looking back on our detection, so we used, we essentially, you know, with any radio telemetry data, there's going to be false positive detections that you have to filter out that occur just as a result of noise. And we used filtering algorithms that we've used in other radio telemetry studies to filter out those false positives. And, you know, that's, those algorithms were developed having a better sense for, or feeling, you know, more confident in what the range of those receivers were, and that if a tag swam by those receivers, it wouldn't be missed or wasn't likely to be missed. So that could potentially be an issue with these data. So we're going to go back and take a look, sort of manually go through some of these detections to try to identify whether or not we've filtered out some valid detections using the power, which we don't typically use in our filtering algorithms, but the power of the detections, and then we'll calculate the antenna or receiver detection probabilities and the emigration rates from there. But just a cursory look at the data showed that, you know, there's maybe four or five fish that that actually successfully emigrated to Willamette Falls and were misclassified as remaining in the San Yam River. So I'm not expecting a huge change in the percent that migrated out of the river, but we'll see. There was a comment that we had 14 fish that were never detected, and the comment was that they should not be included in the group classified as remaining in the South San Yam River, that they should be in their own category as undetected fish, and I guess, you know, they weren't detected because when 200 tags got released all at the same time, the receiver in the Foster tail race got swamped with all of those tags pinging at the same time. And because those fish were never detected again, there are really only two possible scenarios. They either died or remained in the river, so we're going to keep them in that group as having remained in the South San Yam River as either residualized
or mortalities.
And that seems fair to me, as long as mortality is just as equally a possibility as residualization, because it's really unknown, so it's hard to assign it.
Well, I mean, it's not possible that they migrated downstream and because they weren't detected there was a malfunction or something. I mean, it just seems like you don't have any evidence to support them being anywhere, so how do you decide?
Yeah,
you
well, we know that they didn't remain in the hatchery. They they definitely left the hatchery. And I mean, it comes back to the detection efficiency of the receiver stations downstream, which we will recalculate. You know, there's not a lot we can do about the since we weren't in control of those receiver stations. There's not really a lot that we can, you know, we can't go back and test the range now, so we have to use the data we have to estimate their efficiency.
Great. Hey, Ryan, what about the next comment talking about tag burden? You have thoughts on that?
Which one is that? Is that in...
Believe it's the comment after talking about the 14 fish that were never detected after leaving the hatchery. The countdown in bullets, it should be number 7.
All right.
Stated in the results that the residualization rate applies to the radio tagged population. I mean, those are the results of the study, you know, those are the results for the radio tagged population. And we do point out in the discussion that there was obvious issue of tag or tagging effect due to the high proportion of the tagged fish that remained in the hatchery compared to the untagged population. I think a lot of the consternation over this is from the extrapolation to the untagged population, and the comment here from ODFW about the smolt to adult return rates being averaging like 13% if the emigration rate really is only 25%, that sort of hit home with me. And you know, I knew that our residualization rate was likely overestimated, likely due to that tag or tagging effect. But because the residualization rate is overestimated, then the emigration rate is necessarily underestimated. So I'm going to make that point in the report as well. And I think by extrapolating to the untagged population, it provides good evidence that the residualization rate is an obvious overestimate. So I plan to include that in the discussion with that caveat. And like Cam pointed out or asked me during the last hatchery management team meeting, you know, whether or not I thought that 25,000 residual hatchery steelhead was a realistic estimate based on what I saw snorkeling, and I'd definitely say that it was not. So combining that information together, I think, provides support that the residualization rate is overestimated and the emigration rate was underestimated. So I plan to include that in the discussion. I'll take that extrapolation out of the results, but include it in the discussion just as evidence that we have likely overestimated, or that the residualization rate observed for the radio tagged fish is not likely representative of the untagged population.
This is Mark. I would suggest that one of those two is probably the right thing to say. You might not have an overestimate. It seems you have probably an maybe an accurate estimate for your population. It's just that it's not at all representative of what the normal released fish do.
Right, as far as we know.
So it's not an overestimate of the larger population. It's not an estimate for that at all.
Yeah. Based on the snorkeling results, though, there certainly are a fair number of residual hatchery steelhead. I mean, I saw them with my own eyes, so I wouldn't say that it's without question not an issue.
Great, Dave. Do you have any comments specifically that we'd like to address here before moving on?
No. I was just going to ask a question, maybe to the larger group, Brian and others. I mean, it seems to me that I don't care how small a tag PNNL can ultimately develop. When you're in a hatchery handling a whole bunch of fish, doing something to them, regardless of the size of the tag, isn't there always going to be some sort of effect on those fish that were handled versus the ones that were never touched in the hatchery? I would think that the answer would be yes. And so you're going to see something change.
That's an interesting question, Dave. This is Mark. So on the same day that PNNL was out there counting residuals of their tags in the hatchery at South Enneum, I was also out there looking at the number of pit-tagged fish that also residualized or were still left in the hatchery. We released about 15,000, and I can't remember what the PNNL number was, about, what was it, 200? And we found two of our fish, and I lost count of theirs at about 25 or 30.
Yeah, two of the pit tag fish?
Yeah, two of 15,000 versus 25 or 30 of 200.
Yeah, I watched Brian today when they were out there doing the radio tagging, and as kind and gentle as they are to the fish, I mean, it's a procedure, and perhaps if we ever do are able to engage in a future study, and PNNL comes up with a new super tiny tag, it'd be interesting to see what would happen, but maybe we'll cut that group in half that's sitting in the hatchery. It's hard to say. I'm just saying. I think that procedure is going to have an effect on those fish.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'm just speaking to your question that while tag effects might always exist.
Yeah.
The tag effect appeared to be quite different between our two different.
It sounds like it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and the engineers here are currently working on a micro radio transmitter that they think is going to end up weighing about 0.15 grams, so not too much bigger than a pit tag, and have sufficient battery life for this type of study, somewhere around 100 days. But I think it's more of an issue of the invasive surgical procedure that is required to thread that antenna out of the, with the catheter and everything. It's much more invasive than say the surgery that we do with acoustic transmitters that just require a small incision. And so, maybe acoustic telemetry is an option sometime in the future. We have an injectable acoustic transmitter now, so that would be potentially about as invasive as pit tagging would be. However, there's really no good way to mobile track fish with an acoustic transmitter, so we wouldn't necessarily be able to determine the state of fish that remained in the river, but we'd have a better sense of what the immigration rate is, at least to the Willamette.
It does seem like focusing on how to reduce that residualization, with the hatchery change in feed and pit tagging some fish and looking at the results, how we can improve that. I mean, if we all acknowledge there's some residualization going on and we want to reduce it, I mean, that, to me, we can spend a lot of money trying to get the perfect tag for radio tags, or we can, you know, move forward on trying to improve the situation as well.
Yeah. Hey, Bernadette, can you speak up a little bit? You were breaking out every other word, but I think what I gathered was, and said what I think you said, I would agree, is that, you know, regardless of the shortcomings of this study and the radio tag burden, et cetera, it is a fact that they sat in the river for 2 years and watched a whole bunch of hatchery fish establish feeding territories and quite happy and quite fat 50 days after they were released. And so there definitely is a residualization, and these things are steelhead. Maybe they wanted to become rainbow trout again. I don't know. But, if there's any way that, you know, and that's all ultimately Ryan's recommendation was, you know, maybe perhaps evaluate whether there's something you can do in the hatchery program itself to change the feeding regime, and I probably can't control water temperatures very well, but is there any way to get these things truly so they're really, really smolting and just ready to get the heck out of that river and to reduce that residualization rate? I think that would be great.
Yeah, and Dave, you might have missed it, but we did talk a little bit earlier about two different options. One is changing the feeding regime towards the end of the rearing process, and the second is a new feed that Brett is going to try.
Oh, cool.
And it sounds like they've had promising results with that feed in other locations. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like, you know, everyone acknowledges that residualization to some extent is an issue, and we have some new information from Ryan's report, no matter how imperfect it might be. So what are we going to do about it? Well, we have two good options on the table moving forward. And it sounds like potentially with PITTEG study in the future, we might be able to get at that question from another direction.
That's great. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Thank you, Ryan. Are there any other questions for Ryan? Otherwise, like I said, we'll put together this response paper, and I'll talk to Ryan after the meeting about whether he can actually go in and rewrite the study itself, and if he just doesn't have time, because I know he doesn't have money. Well, like I said, we'll just append the comments to the back of the report and resend it back out. One way or another, we'll address them.
Just thanks, Ryan, for your willingness to address the comments. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Ryan. That's much appreciated.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for the comments.
All right, moving on. Gate repairs at Lookout Point. Cam, I know you had some questions
about
that.
I don't know what the implications exactly are going to be and whether we've got plans in place for dealing with them.
Right. Was any kind of coordination form sent out to regional agencies?
I put it on the agenda so I could be told what happened.
Okay.
Dan and I spoke a little bit about it. He's got some thoughts on what will happen, but mm-hmm. I just kind of wanted to be educated.
Yeah. This is something that strikes me as an issue that would require a coordination form to be sent out to regional agencies and then receive comments back when they're deciding when to do this. And I don't know if that ever occurred. I wasn't part of it if it did.
I can't say I've ever seen a form. I know we've been talking about it.
Yeah.
You know, or the Corps has been letting us know it was going to happen. and we've been asking for studies to kind of accompany that, to look
sure.
at fish response to that change in reservoir condition.
Right.
But I don't remember any coordination for them.
Yeah, that's what we do on the Columbia, and that's what I'm familiar with. So it might be useful to do one after the fact here, but as far as details of what's going on, I have some of that information.
Okay.
For you right now.
Dan, are you still on the phone? Peck?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Do you know anything about a formal coordination, what you call it?
Coordination
negative.
Form?
Okay.
I don't think one happened.
Okay.
So here's some info on what's going on. And Doug, feel free to jump in and correct me if I'm wrong about any of this. Basically, we have been rehabbing gates throughout the valley at various projects, and Lookout Point is on the list. This is obviously a big safety issue for flood control, primarily in human safety. So they're going to rehab three different gates this year. Two gates will be rehabbed from mid-July to mid-November. That was the time frame that was identified. And the third gate will be rehabbed from mid-September to mid-November. And there's a couple other gates at that project, and they'll do one gate per year in subsequent years from now. Basically, what they're going to do is they need to get these gates in the dry, so they're going to lower the reservoir elevation, and it'll be about 58 feet below the normal max summer elevation. So they're going to aim for about 867.5 feet in the reservoir to do this work. So basically, it will be very limited, if at all, to be able to do any kind of temperature management.
I'm sorry, what was the elevation again?
867.5.
And so 867.5,
okay.
They're planning to bring it down so it's at that elevation in July, and then next year they're planning not to fill it. Is that correct? Not to fill it up. I mean, this year they're filling it up and then bringing it down. And aren't they planning to leave it down so it doesn't fill next year?
Next year? I'm not sure what the plan is for next year. I'm, like, kind of new to this gate repair thing as well, so I can dig into the information. I'm sure it exists. But that one doesn't start until mid-September. So.
Hey, you guys, it's Doug. I'll try to get a schedule tentative for the group on this, on the process of getting these inner gates replaced. Or fixed, I mean, refurbed at Lookout.
Great.
So are there predictions on what this will do at for temperatures at that time at Dexter?
I haven't seen any predictions for what it will do to temperatures at Dexter.
Be warmer, though, right?
Mm-hmm. Likely, yeah. So what I understand is in the past, since 2012 when we started doing temperature management, they've attempted to mix the warmer water from the spill gates, which would be unavailable, with the colder water from the turbines and the ROs. So we won't have that warmer water from the top.
Okay, see, this is why I want to know what's going on.
Yeah, but with this year, I'm not quite sure what will happen. Doug might have a better idea than I would.
Well, if you can't spill,
you're going to be pulling off the
bottom. You're going to be pulling off the bottom, so wouldn't it be colder than normal? I mean, it's like the temperature control to add the warm water.
Add the warmer water.
Right? It'll be colder than last year.
Yeah, you guys, it'll essentially be... Oh, sorry, Jeff.
Yeah, go ahead.
I would say it's going to essentially be the same as before we did the interim control temperature control measures using the spill gate.
Yeah.
So it would be like the old days. But besides the low water year, which we know the low water year is always headaches.
So for the sake of avoiding confusion, do you want to do an MOC on this and clearly lay that out?
Yeah, we should. That would be my action.
So Dan, is that making sense to you? You know a lot more about this than I do.
Yeah, it's going to be warmer than it has the last since 12. But my concern is if you've looked at Lookout right now, it's lower than it's ever been. So we're not starting with full pool. We're already low, and with these summer temperatures, that incoming water is going to be warmer than normal. So you're not going to have that cold water that you normally pull off of. So it's going to be warmer than it's. My guess is it's going to be warmer than it's ever been.
Okay.
You guys, it's Doug. I would, if you want to just kind of take a wild guess, maybe go back and look at 2001 temperatures down there.
That's just one. Just
shooting at the hip, yep.
The other wild card in this is, you know, it can rain.
It can rain. I forgot all about that stuff. Yeah, that stuff.
It did rain last weekend.
Dan, off the top of your head, do you remember what 2001 looked like, or warmer water years in the past?
No, I'd have to go back and dig through.
Okay.
Okay.
Without dragging it on and getting into weeds, I don't know what's going to happen, but we should be able to predict it or mm-hmm. a range of outcomes. Over this time frame, and tie that in with what Dan needs at Dexter for rearing.
Yeah.
And see if there's anything going to be really complicating. One of the things Dan brought up is the need, if fish start breaking at higher rates with whatever, we need medicated feed that we haven't ordered and don't have the money for, and don't even know whether we need it. So if you can't order it, you can't order $30,000 worth of medicated feed if you're not pretty sure you're going to use it.
Right.
So how do we deal with that? That's mitigation for what's happening at the dam. And I guess that would be something like an emergency purchase or something.
Well, the medicated feed, in some cases you can't get it until you can diagnose the disease and start the order. But
right.
I don't know how you're going to respond. I believe, Dan, you put some extra dollars in the budget for this year, anticipating that need, didn't you?
Yeah, correct. I know with the water temperatures, you know, since 12 when we started doing the temperature control, our medicated feed levels at Dexter have dropped. And so I kind of bumped the budget back up in feed dollars as, you know, what they were prior to 12. My concern is there was a couple years in the mid-2000s. It wasn't 01. It was since then. But, you know, where we were treating almost all of September, October, November because of warm water, and it was back and forth, back and forth, back and forth between the raceways, and you know, we were looking at $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 worth of feed that we hadn't budgeted for. And that's, you know, that's the unknown that we don't know. I mean, we're the gate repairs have to be done. I understand that. It just, it's terrible that it has to be on a drought year also.
Yeah.
FYI, the lake level in 2001 got to 875.
Okay. Yeah, I can go back and look. It'll take me a little while to dig through, but
just like that. Yeah.
So with the extra that you have in your budget for this year, Dan, do you think you'd be able to cover that?
No. I mean, it just, you don't know how bad it's going to be. Yeah. I mean, and you know, like John said, you can't get your medicated feed until after they're diagnosed, and you know, the vets have to sign off on the drug and all that sort of stuff. So, of course, the later in the season you go, the more medicated feed you need, because you feed it at a percent body weight. So the larger the fish, the more feed, which ups the cost. So,
right.
I don't. No, I mean, I put enough in there to treat everything twice, which is, you know, once at least is normal. But if we have a year like we had a few years ago where we're treating 6-8 times, no, I'm not even close to enough. But I didn't want to give Byrne a heart attack and ask for another $100,000 in feed dollars.
Yeah.
And then not need it. I mean, you know, if maybe we go through just fine. It's just something that, just as long as everybody realizes that we could be in trouble if they do break really bad.
Okay. Well, that's good for me to know, and I'll just be prepared, and we can touch base as we get closer to maybe see a request from you guys for a little bit of extra money if we need more medicated feed towards that time of the year.
Yeah, and it'll probably be August, September before we start to see it.
Okay. Besides just medicated feed, what other kind of options do we have? Moving fish to other locations, or early releases, or any other things
Dan,
you want to talk about?
Do you have fish at Dexter that early?
Oh, yeah. They go down starting mid-May, okay. Third week of May.
I know. Hole, but I don't know if we'd be allowed to move.
Yeah. Some question for Lance.
Are there any implications at the hatchery? Conceivably? Probably not, right?
I wouldn't think so.
No, not, and it's not from the gates, not at all. I mean, you know, the only other thing would be, you know, late returning adults, depending on how warm the water is below Dexter, you know, they're going to be in probably pretty sour shape, depending on how fast that water warms up. Starting in July, you know, I don't know how warm that water is going to be below Dexter, but adults would be the only other thing that I would worry about, would just be the quality of them.
So all right. We start looking hard for problems that might start occurring as early as August.
When in the process of working these gates, will they be at 867 by mid-July, because that's when they plan to start? Or is that when they start? So they're going to be dropping the water in July or June.
If they ever get it.
Yeah, or 1st of July,
yeah,
from
so
what I understand.
Okay.
Yeah, so construction starts
July
15th.
Yeah, they want to start.
This is a graph that I think Catherine Tackley or Chris
Doug, what's the level now, currently?
I'm here, guys. Sorry, I'm at Fall Creek, though, releasing the fish. I'll get that for you right now.
It's already pretty low.
It is. It is.
Okay. Any other discussion on this that we want to have? I'm going to put together a little coordination form that has some of this pertinent info, send it out to the group, be prepared for a request for more funding for Medicaid feed later on in the summer.
I keep thinking about the other options. I like the idea of if we have to decrease loading at Dexter, find a home at McKenzie or something. If that's an option, I don't know. There's lots going on, a lot of moving parts. But
I mean, we created a big hole in McKenzie the last 2 years. We know we can raise there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the desirable thing to do, but if they're going to die, then we get another option.
Right.
Just keep thinking about it because it's not a great year for this to happen. But I'm assuming that asking for you to put it off for a year. Unlikely.
So maybe what I can do is list some of the options in that coordination forum and get everyone's comments on them.
Right.
Move forward from there.
However, in the future, when things like this come up, you could make that request if we haven't already just told you we're going to do this. Ideally, when these things come up, the coordination forum goes out before the contract is in place, and then you can have input on, well, here's a better timing for us based on whatever your needs are.
Okay.
That's where we're moving to.
All right.
Hey, guys. Hey, it's Doug. Sorry to interrupt. The elevation I have currently for lookout is 843.6.
Thanks, Doug.
That's about 8 days into the filling schedule.
And we're lower than what it's going to be is what they're calling it for the summer.
Yeah, we should be for this date. We should be at 892.
Yeah, we're under, for sure. Oh, yeah. I get your percentage. And we hit lookout pretty good, too, because it's our biggest. If we have a drought year, typically. 46% below.
So is the plan to go ahead and try to fill it, or are we just going to go to that 867 and maintain?
I don't know, RCC. I would imagine they would. It's hard to say. It's hard to say. I couldn't tell you that.
Hey, Dan, I'll get that information. I'll send it out to the group.
Okay, thanks.
So, my apologies that this wasn't coordination that happened prior to scheduling this work, but like Tammy said, in the future, that's what we'll try to move to. All right, the last major item that we need to discuss today, number 8, alteration to outplant strategies. This was something that Cam requested that we might discuss, given the temperatures and flows that we might see this year.
So one of the outcomes from Mike Colvin's work and from the U of I pre-spawning mortality study was to try to predict management actions that could be put in place under circumstances like what we're getting right now. And to my knowledge, neither of those have been kind of boiled down to the point where they've made a little model that you could just plug in the numbers and say, okay, this is what we're supposed to do. But the intent was to answer questions like, in a year like this, should we try something different than is what standard operating procedure? Like, for example, at Foster, it's if a fish enters the trap, as quickly as possible, transport that fish up to Gordon Road or Riverbend or something.
Right.
Well, both facilities, Minto and Foster, were built with long-term adult holding ponds for this purpose, to hold fish for a while before outplanting them. And is this the year we try that? And I don't know what the answer is. I'm concerned that with the water year, we might have very high pre-spawning mortality. We predict very high pre-spawning mortality if we use standard operating procedures. But I could be wrong. It could rain. We could have snow. It snowed in June before. Thought we'd bring it up as a discussion. We're set up to do it. Should we do it?
It makes sense to me. We have those tools at our disposal now.
So in the proposal for above dam pre-spawning mortality work, that's in there as an option. And Dexter and I think at Foster too, is to get radio tags in fish that are outplanted late. I guess we'd have to bring that up at a higher level to decide whether it's going to be approved. In the past, it's not been approved. Studies where we have delayed outplanting, so holding a fish on station until later in the season, then outplant them just before spawning, and measure whether you have higher spawning success interseeding that way or not.
Lance, do you have any thoughts on this topic?
Yeah, I guess what's rolling around in my mind is, you know, I wouldn't want to put all our eggs in one basket, so maybe a mixed approach where you have some outplanting and then you do some long-term holding. But then also, you know, that has to be kind of specific to the location. You know, if the tail race at Foster temps aren't that great, then we need to look at that, whereas Minto may be a little bit better. You know, take those site-specific things into account too. But yeah, I think we want to be real careful about it.
Yeah, in 2001, I had to take the adults from Minto over to McKenzie because of high temps.
So how do we want to approach this as we get closer?
I'd like to get Chris Caudill in the loop on it, because I believe it's already been drafted into the proposed work that's in review right now for funding, and get it on people's screens for permitting, because it's obviously going to be some permitting issues with the NIPS, because we're not doing what is the normal program. So
the other thing is, you know, with the temperatures we have now, those fish are going to show up probably earlier than average too. And so that'll, you know, if we're holding them for quite a bit longer than we normally would, you know, consider that too.
So for next hatchery management team meeting, could we invite Chris to think about whether this is going to be pushed forward?
Yeah.
And I, for my part, will nag Mike Colvin, who is in the middle of developing the model that's supposed to kind of frame the management options and put thresholds in there where you kind of pull triggers to do different management actions. And then the hoser took a real job. So, and I don't think it's finished, but I know it was a tool that was in development and a pretty good one up to the point where he move back to the East Coast.
And do you know?
Well, another thing that comes to mind on this subject, you know, and it's not really appropriate for our team, but all of the agencies are represented in. You know, we do no water temperature management at all through the TRIBS and main stem for adult migration in spring Chinook. And maybe encourage all of the agencies to kind of look at that this year and see what opportunities there are to do more of that, you know, to track it, to use the water in the reservoirs to aid migration of adults, you know, put it, eventually we need to put in some standards on that to really change flow management and gear it towards, you know, spring Chinook adult migration and all those things, you know, similar to what the Corps does on the Rogue. They got it dialed down really well there and it works good. But, you know, for the Willamette, it's really a shame. We don't talk about that at all. And that has direct bearing on pre-spawn mortality and all these things that we're going to really have to deal with this year.
So, Lance, do you have ideas or proposals that we might want to pursue or that have been or should be presented to flow management team?
I don't know all the specifics, but, you know, it's never really, I don't know what kind of work the Corps has done to look at it. You know, Greg Taylor would probably be the best one to talk with first on that, but there's definitely some opportunities. I mean, some of the USGS work show, once you get in the main stem, you're not talking about huge decreases in temperature, but it is some, you know, that's driven by or regulated by flow. So there definitely is opportunities, but we just aren't talking about it at all.
Yeah. Well, I think we should, especially if there's low-hanging fruit or easy things that we can change right now, we should do it. And if there's things that might complicate other functions of flow, we can definitely make the argument from the fish standpoint to potentially change those things in the future.
I agree with Lance, guys. Greg would be a good place to start. He's got that perspective. Probably the best of all of us.
All right.
So you were also asking about, I think, Mike Colvin's model, what it's based on? Is that what?
Yeah. What his thresholds were based on?
So they've got, fundamentally, it's a thermal exposure predictive model for mortality associated with thermal exposure. So they took radio telemetry data from the U of I work. They took historical temperature data, the U of I's the temperature data from the basically thermometers that are attached to the radio tags, when they recovered radio tags, thermographs, I think they were called. Took that all together and boiled it down into measuring actual, predicting actual pre-spawning mortality rates based on thermal exposure. And then if there are thermal regimes that exceed some threshold where you get high pre-spawning mortality, then that triggered you doing something else. And one of the options was holding the fish in cold, clean water at a facility like Midtill or Foster.
Cool. Okay, so moving on from this one, it sounds like general approval for maybe looking at a mixed approach to outplanting, doing some immediately, maybe holding some for later on. I'm going to talk to Caudill about coming to the next HMT. About some ideas that might already be in the works.
I think they're already in the proposal, as I recall.
Yeah, and then you were going to...
I'm going to talk to Colvin and find out where it sits right now, the completion of that.
Okay. Mm.
Might be good to get the, I don't know if it's Kim Hatfield or whoever is reviewing those permits in on the discussion, too. Yeah. So she's aware.
Yeah, as soon as we can.
Yeah.
All right. And then I might talk with Greg Taylor about maybe... Sounds like there might be some long-term changes we want to make, or maybe some short-term easy ones for tent management.
I'd like to see what, Lance, the Rogue River situation, is there a report that kind of concisely describes how that works?
Yeah, yep.
I'd love to see that.
Yeah, they have temperature targets down in the lower Rogue at Agnes that are what, probably... 100 miles from the dam that they manage temperature at, you know, specifically for spring Chinook, and it's really good. It's worked good. They've been able to deal with the pre-spawning mortality very well.
So if you could send a link to, again, a concise description of how that works and how it was developed, that would be useful. I'd love to see it.
Could you send that to the whole group, Lance?
Yeah, sure.
Thank you. All right, anything else on outplanting strategies for this year? Sounds like we got some good items moving forward. Okay, moving on. Number 9, pit tag antennas at fish collection facility ladders. I asked Fenton about this, and he's the one that's leading the effort. That infrastructure maintenance and repairs for the Willamette. So he had a couple things to say for folks that are looking at the web meeting. I pulled this up. This is directly from Fenton. It sounds like the Foster Fish Weir pit antenna is actually going back into service and collecting data today as we are talking right now. And he's working on securing funding for the antennas for the ladders at Foster and Minto AFFs. He says the plan is to install the antennas in the ladder this winter maintenance period, if all goes well. And he said he'll give us some updates as things progress.
So stopping there then.
Yeah.
That means that for this sampling season, my crews again have the hatchery staff and my crews again, if they want to interrogate fish for pit tags, they have to do it one at a time.
By hand.
Yeah, by hand. All day long, every time they handle fish.
Magic wand.
Yep. I don't like that. That's a royal. It does not work very well.
I'm sure, yeah. I understand.
Okay.
Hopefully, it's the last year of that.
The grand finale.
It sounds like the antenna infrastructure at Bennett and Staten Dams is working well. And then, like we touched on before, the infrastructure at Lebanon Dam is in the works. ODFW apparently plans to be installing these antennas at the two ladders and bypass pipes during March and April.
Like,
do you know who's doing that?
Yeah, so, okay. Luke Whitman told me the name of the fellow. He's ODFW out of the Dalles Screen Shop, I think. And
I forgot. Derek Faber, I think.
Ah, thanks, Tom. So it's an ODFW worker. It's Corps funded, right? Is that right? I mean, the Corps.
I think so.
I don't know anything about it.
Yeah.
But he's the one that did a bunch of stuff on Bennett. I think at Lieber.
Okay.
So I guess it's going on.
So he has experience doing it?
Yeah.
If it's Derek Faber, he has a lot of experience. He used to work on the Columbia.
So the Lebanon Dam one is an important one because that would be the detector for pit tag steelhead if we managed to pull that off for next year's migrants. So,
I mean, there isn't any place else you could put one in between there and Willamette Falls. I mean, there's...
That's it. You're there. Yeah. That's your only option, as far as I know.
Yeah. So that's what Fenton had to say.
Okay.
Did it answer questions?
Yeah.
More or less.
So the problem is I know that the ladders were designed to accept antennas at Foster and Minto. And it just seems like, well, why didn't that just happen? Because
during construction.
They were designed for it. And this is not as expensive as those big stainless steel turnbuckles at the different facilities. Those are twice or three times as expensive as a pit tag detection system. And I don't know why. I'm whinging. Our crews will do it. Greg and Brett both developed a frame, a rack, and everything for a really cool pit tag detector. The problem is it is not connected to Patagis, so it's not running P3, so you're not getting queryable detections. All you're doing is recording detection and hope it's working. And then later on, you download those and then process the data. But when Griff and I were, mostly Griff's, first started talking about this about 3 years ago, in our mind's eye, it was a system running P3 so that you knew what you were finding as the fish were coming into the system. You knew that a paired release fish had returned to Dexter, or a wild fish that was tagged by Luke's crews in the Mackenzie was coming into your system. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not the way it's going to work.
And why not?
Because it has to be attached to a running computer that is actually running P3. The software
for have to have a connection between your
so the detector has to be connected to a laptop, and with an internet connection at the same time. Now all it is a recorder. It just records the code. And the time, a time stamps a record of that number in the pit tag. We can work with it.
Is there any reason we couldn't do a laptop running P3?
Yeah, it's a very, very wet environment. It has to be.
Yeah, but we have boxes all the time.
I think we
have laptops all over the place. Barnacle Dam, that's the wettest place in the gorge. It's not that hard.
Conceivably, I guess.
Somebody just want to have to construct.
We had envisioned a system, not just a patched together thing. Jared Rube Goldberg apparatus.
Yeah.
Something like what we've got at Willamette Falls.
Yeah.
Libor,
hey Cam, this is Brett. Are we gonna have to look for coded wire tags and all the Chinook again this year?
Coded wire tags?
I mean the pit tag, excuse me.
Yes.
And hatchery and unmarked fish?
Yes.
Okay. Just a second.
Sorry, Brett.
That's right.
Well, Brett's got between Brett and Greg, they've got a nice system.
Yeah.
It seems to work. And we'll have staff on hand to help and all that. It's just that it's not...
It's not as slick.
It's not as efficient.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's no extra. I mean, you just slide them underneath the, you know, you set it up to where when you slide them down the table, they go underneath that hoop, so...
It's pretty easy.
Not any additional work, really.
So. I'll come out and help you again.
Hey, that'd be fun.
Are you allowed outside? I'm allowed.
We'll take it.
As much as I can get it. All right, anything else on pit antennas? Nope. Okay, anything else in general? Otherwise, we'll wrap this up today. Nobody in the room? Anybody on the phone?
I think we got it.
All right, thank you guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Andy. Good job.
Talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Did we find a tank?
With a...
I'm certain that's a non-CDL truck.
But 10 times out of 10, if you want to work it this way, you don't need to carry more than 10 fish. So a 300-gallon tank with a one-ton works just fine, as long as it's got at least an 8-inch...
It's the opening on them. We were putting steelhead at Rock Creek last week, and... Truck comes in with a little tank in the back of the truck, a tank on the trailer. We get 30-some fish off, and we're done. You know, and I know there's a tank like that at Leeburg.
On the trailer, yeah. It's
on the trailer. And
mine. You can't have it.
That's just kidding. Just kidding.
No, HRMD paid for half.
Oh, okay.
And Mackenzie paid for the other half.
You can have part of it.
You can have half.
We've been using that. We use that for transporting fish, but we weren't comfortable with using the exit.
Does it have a small opening?
Kind of small. It's big enough. Okay? A fish will fit. Most fish. Almost all fish.
Unless one goes like this.
Yeah, the sideways.
Yeah. That 1,000-gallon one, I know it was a 12-inch one, because I had to take them an adapter on Monday so they could drop it to 6.
Okay.
To stock trouts and smolts and stuff. So it's got the big giant orifice on it.
But think about the logistics there, okay? So we're going to have a truck there for fish to take to broodstock up at the hatchery. Another truck for loading fish to go up the North Fork, Middle Fork. Another truck with a tank in the back or a trailer attached to get any unclipped fish. And they're all going to be lined up right there at Dexter. And somehow...
This fish over there.
A fish goes there, fish goes there, fish goes there.
Water to water, right?
To water. Sorry.
Which is fortunate.
that could be a cluster.
The other one, I know I got an email from Jeff. He doesn't want to release steelhead through the discharge pipe anymore. You know where the fishing crew? Yeah, where the fishing crew sits there and,
yeah.
and catch. They don't want to release them. He wants to release them downstream to improve the quality of the fishery.
And to improve the quality of the people sitting around.
Yeah,
you know, there's some sketchy people.
It's like going to, have you been out on the Sandy?
I have not, but I've been to the Cowlitz Blue River fishery.
Oh, probably the same thing.
Same damn thing.
The same people.
Yeah, you might have 30 people with 20 teeth among them.
Yeah, it looks like work release from the county jail.